Morning, everybody.
Welcome. My name is Brian Simoneau. I'm class of 99, and I feel very lucky to get to introduce Amy and Clay this morning. I have no real remarks. I'm going to keep it brief because we want to take a look at some of their work. Amy Giza, class of 99, is an artist and an assistant professor at the Community College of Rhode Island. Clay Williams, class of 99 as well, is a Brooklyn-based photographer and blogger. And this morning we're going to hear them talk about some of their recent photography projects, and we'll get to see some examples of their work. First up is Amy.
Hello. Okay. I actually decided that rather than focus exclusively on my most recent work, I actually kind of wanted to go back because I actually discovered photography here at Amherst. My first ever photography class that I took was my sophomore year with a professor that soon left thereafter. But I fell in love with photography, and I've been really and truly doing it ever since I left here. So I thought I'd kind of trace the progress of my work from Amherst to where I am now, because it's kind of a bizarre journey. So believe it or not, those are some examples of my work from when I was a student here. The bottom left and the image on the right are from Fairweather, and that was the old black box studio that was under renovation. And some crazy person in the art department gave me a key to it and let me run around in there. And take pictures. And that really kind of sparked a trajectory for my work for a long time. The early work is mostly from when I was in school. I kind of went through this process where I left Amherst and I had this wild dream that I was going to be an artist and had no real path to figure out how to be an artist. And it took me a really long time to figure out how to really make a living doing what I wanted to do. And so at one point, I had this crazy idea. I was like, well, you know, I'm sitting here waiting tables, trying to pay the bills. I might as well do commercial photography to pay the bills and then do my art on the weekend. And so the New England School of Photography, I was living in Boston. New England School of Photography is this phenomenal two-year certificate program that does commercial photography. And I went there, and all of a sudden, I'm doing art again. And had absolute, like, I ended up majoring in advertising photography, but this is some of the color work that I did. And I'm showing this because even at that point, I was really interested in exploring my personal spaces and kind of what the space around me, how it influenced me, how I interacted with it, how it helped define who I was. Some of the images are for, I was in a triple-decker in Somerville, and if any of you have been in Somerville and know about the triple-deckers there, they are iconic, and the basements are terrifying, so some of them are from the basement of my triple-decker. And just small, old, kind of very Somerville houses, and that really influenced me in a lot of ways. This was what I ended up doing for my advertising portfolio, which I thought was amazing that my instructor would let me do this. Basically, halfway through the program, I realized that I was going to be an artist, and the whole commercial thing wasn't real. Like, I tried, and I tried really valiantly, but I came to him and I said, you know, I really love art history. I love Vanitas-style paintings. What do you think about me making fun of the entire industry of advertising in my final portfolio? And he's like, yes, that's a great idea. So he let me do this, so I kind of riffed off the idea of Vanitas paintings and turned them into ads and tried to really take a creative spin on that, and so that kind of gave me a lot of, studying advertising photography really gave me a very strong skill set. Like, I knew my camera inside and out, and it kind of paved the way for how things kind of went from there. What I really ended up doing when I was at NESOP was this black and white project, which was kind of a continuation of the self-portraiture that I did when I was here at Amherst. I was really interested in exploring issues of identity and understanding myself and how I kind of interacted with myself and the different sides of my personality, but also very much where I lived and interacting with the space that helped kind of define who I was at that time. So believe it or not, all of these images were shot with a plastic toy camera called a Holga, and I just shot overlapping frames, and I actually would really kind of pre-visualize everything and force myself to interact with myself in a really strange way. And I really loved this body of work, and it was amazing, and I got so excited about this, and I finished up at NESOP, and I realized that I really, and then I actually was really lucky, and I got to be a teaching assistant at the school, and I was like, oh, I'm going to teach. This is the path. And So finally kind of came to this realization, and so then I realized, oh, crap, I have to go back to school again. Because if you want to teach, you need a master's, and NESOP doesn't count. So I went to grad school, and my very first summer at Parsons, I was coming fresh off of this self-portraiture work, and this is the kind of work that I started exploring, and they were encouraging us to do multimedia work and to kind of play around with different things, and in all honesty, I got reamed. at a lot of professors, they're like, art is not therapy, you should not be, you know, why are you doing self-portraiture, what's the point of doing this at this point, what are you really contributing to the dialogue, and it was very interesting, and in some ways I got really frustrated by that. It was really interesting to have somebody be like, you shouldn't be doing the work that you've been doing for about 6 years at this point. But in some ways, it was actually a really interesting thing. And so my work kind of, I tried to push it political. This was about 2007, 2008, so gearing up to the 2008 presidential election. I was really interested in politics. And so I was using appropriated photographs and casting them in resin and trying to create physical objects where there are these kind of forced juxtapositions. And these also were not really well received. I loved them. I enjoyed making them. At one point I was working with a specific resin and it gave me a rash, so that was maybe not a good idea. But I really enjoyed making them, but critically, the professors were really rough. And so I was frustrated all the time, and so I started making work about being frustrated. And I tried to piss off my professors because they were pissing me off, and so this kind of dialogue started happening. And so I started trying to make images of nothing. I started collecting ice. I started trying to do things that wouldn't be permanent, that wouldn't last, because I was like, well, if you're going to tell me that everything I'm doing is worthless, why should I really engage with your kind of mentality? And also at this time, up until this point, I'd been working with appropriated images. I'd been doing a lot of digital work. I was, like, everybody in my program was working digitally. And all of this was film. And so that I realized that one of the big things for me is that I needed to get back in the darkroom. So both of the images that are, one of them is not showing up as anything, those are actually darkroom images. One is a color darkroom photogram, the other is a black and white darkroom photogram. And this image kind of sparked something for me, and then I went, so that's my finger right down there, and I was kind of working with the idea of putting myself into it but not letting people realize that it was my body or it was my figure in the images and really trying to obscure some information, and then I started interacting in my bedroom, and I started recording shadows at night on the wall and getting rid of the camera completely and getting rid of any kind of lens, and really trying to capture just a raw space. And that actually really turned into my thesis work, and it's actually the project that I'm still doing today. So that's kind of the trajectory that got me to where I am right now. And it's this idea of recording shadow patterns at night and trying to have that very visceral reaction of light on paper that I'm really interested in, but also kind of an unmediated experience. These are actual shadow patterns. They're unmanipulated. I have no say in what happens. All I do is I pick the point where I want to record the shadows, and then I develop them. And I don't get it really, you know, I do some test exposures, but a lot of it is chance, which is really interesting for me because I'm a bit of a control freak. But to give you a sense of the scale, they're really large scale murals. And so this was the work that I did, and these were all recorded in New York. And then, I threw this in. All my work from now on is kind of darkroom work that I decided to show, but one of the side projects that kind of came out, I finished grad school, I'm still doing work, and murals are expensive and big, and they are really difficult to store. So I needed a project that I could kind of keep my hand in and keep working on a regular basis, and I got an iPhone and started taking cell phone pictures and playing around and breaking, so I threw that in. I'm sorry, I meant to take that out. I got a couple of opportunities which were amazing to create site-specific images. So this was an opportunity that I had in an art organization called Real Artways that's in Hartford, Connecticut. And they basically gave me this little, again, a black box studio, normally for video projections and kind of performance spaces. And I said, the walls are black, can I have that space? And they gave it to me. And it's an old typewriter factory down in Hartford, and they gave me access to a couple of studios that were above the gallery, and I made some recordings up in there. So that was a really amazing experience to have the opportunity to make something that was really site-specific and then install it in the gallery downstairs. And then I had another opportunity back at NESOP. They have a gallery space there, and I actually thought it would be amazing to be able to go back to the school where I had kind of rediscovered that I wanted to be an artist, and I got access to a classroom. And I kind of recorded the entire classroom and then installed that into the gallery space. And then I kind of get to the new work. I'm going to pause here for a second. The project that this is all a part of is called Concealed at First, at Last I Appear, which is actually a quote that I pulled from Fox Talbot, William Henry Fox Talbot, who's one of the original inventors of photography. And that idea of having something ephemeral be permanently recorded was something that I was really interested in. And so there are all these kind of different variations on this project that I've been working on. The large-scale murals are something that I love doing, but again, the kind of, you need access to space and time, and it's a bit of an interesting headache sometimes. However, small-scale things are much easier to kind of work with and access on a regular basis. So these are actually the newest part of the project. These are all 11 by 14, and these are all actually black and white paper. But I recently discovered a process that it's a two-part chemical process that you do in the darkroom, and it actually allows you to change the size and shape of the grains of silver so it refracts color instead of white light. And depending on the paper and depending on the mix of the chemistry, you can pull different colors out of the paper. So I've been really playing around with recording the spaces of my house and then also working in the darkroom and pulling these different colors, so it's almost a cross between painting and photography. It's still that kind of, people think of photography as this kind of mechanical process. You have a machine and it creates the image. And in a large sense, I don't have a lot of say except where I place the paper. But then in the darkroom, I'm actually painting with the chemicals. So there's this cross between photography and painting and the mark of the hand and the mark of the machine to a certain extent, though there's still no camera. But it's been really kind of amazing for me to see the different marks that I'm able to make and the different colors. The other thing that's really interesting for me that's kind of an even newer development that I, like Monday, is a lot of the papers that you see here that I have been working with are expired. I'm now like the local go-to, like if somebody's cleaning out their darkroom, I'm like, give me your paper. Monday I'm driving to Rhode Island so that I can get some paper. Because somebody's getting rid of paper that they don't make anymore. There are a lot of manufacturers that are gone. Forte and Agfa and some beautiful papers that I can't get my hands on. So the green color, which is one of my favorites, is Forte paper and they don't make it anymore. So anytime I hear anybody who's giving away paper, I'm rushing to try and find it. But in a lot of ways, there's a little bit of a conflict in that I can't get at a lot of the materials anymore. And so there's a little bit of this shift of what's going on with the darkroom and everything that's happening in photography that is starting to creep its way back into the work. These are the most recent. These are about 5x7, and these are actually, there's no recorded image in this. These are just kind of painted marks. This was me kind of practicing my mark-making ability and trying to discover what different, like, there was a brand of paper that somebody gave me that I think is from the 1960s, and I had never seen it before, and I decided that I maybe should do some tests before I did anything really big with those. So kind of, it's a constant experimentation. It's really funny. My husband is a scientist, and so frequently I think about the fact that I approach a lot of what I do with photography with that same kind of experimental nature, where it's, I think something's going to happen, and then I go in the darkroom and I see if it actually does happen. But I think that's the last slide. It is. So that's my work.
So I am sort of totally opposite what Amy's experience has been. I discovered photography in high school, but in one of those weird sort of adolescent, like, high school's over, I'm not doing those things anymore, college is going to be a whole different thing. I entirely let it drop when I got to Amherst. I think I was in Fairweather once for a friend's play, and that was about it. In fact, I was just talking to my wife earlier and realized that I don't think I took any art classes here at all. I don't know. I sort of, now I'm thinking maybe I should have. But in any case, I don't, I am on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of, you know, there's a lot of back and forth about is photography art, and there's art photography versus documentary photography or photojournalism, that sort of thing. I tend to be a lot more on the documentary photojournalism side. I mean, there is still art to it. There's still composition. There's still making an image in a lot of ways. But it's obviously an entirely different sort of thing. Most of what I do is, what I shoot is for websites and magazines. Obviously, my main area is food. Looks a little different on the slideshow, but yeah, on the projector. But yeah, so I mean, that's sort of the way I got into food. Well, actually, let me get through some of these. And it'll be, I think it'll be about lunchtime by the time we're out. So if everyone's running out the door to get some food after this, then I guess I'll have done my job well. So I got into food and drink. After school, I had started, I started blogging. I actually started picking up photography as a hobby to, out of school, I ended up being an IT guy. That was my, you know, that's who I sort of defined myself as out of college. I was a computer geek, and that was my day job, and I did all of that. And I got back into photography and cameras with digital photography. And and I was just playing with the computer side of things, and then I realized that I was really getting into it. I started writing blog posts that were, you know, usually about food and what's going on in Brooklyn or my travel or anything like that, and I was taking the photos to illustrate things, and then over time I came to discover that I actually liked the photos more than the words. And so these days I shoot for I shoot food and drink and events for magazines and websites. Most recently, I got the cover of Edible Jersey, which is a local food magazine down in the New York, New Jersey area, and you know, that's pretty exciting. That literally just came out, so I'm still sort of riding that. I've gotten some photos in Travel and Leisure and the New York Times and some other titles. I ended up going, sorry for the vegetarians, I started getting into the whole food thing with butcher classes, or the food photography thing, with butchery classes. I went to a class something like 10 years ago where someone was taking apart a whole pig, and I found that, like, fascinating. I mean, both as someone who likes to cook, but also just seeing behind the scenes, seeing what was happening, seeing how those things happened. You know, I love eating out, I love, you know, cooking at home, and to go into the kitchen of a, you know, a proper restaurant and see, like, how they make the things that, you know, that we all, like, rave about. I found it, you know, fascinating. And so, you know, I started out by just, you know, whenever we'd go to a restaurant with an open kitchen, I'd always request, like, to sit as close to that as possible so that I could take some photos and annoy my wife. you know, and I did more and more of that, and I would use it in the blog posts and that sort of thing. And eventually I started asking, hey, do you mind if I, you know, I shoot for, you know, I blog in these places, and, like, would it be cool if I were to come in and photograph you guys, you know, while you're at work? And a lot of times they were like, are you crazy? No. But you do it enough times, and you ask enough times, and you end up you end up getting access to some great places. So one of the places that I shoot regularly is at the James Beard House, where if you're not, like, food obsessed, you may have never heard of it, but they're sort of the academy for, like, the food world. They have the big food awards every year. Restaurants from all over the country, especially, but around the world, will come in maybe 20 nights a week, 20 nights a month to put on, at their own expense, a meal for, you know, 70 people, just to say that they've served at the Beard House. And so once or twice a month, I go in and I'll see, you know, these teams of, like, trained professionals going through, like, in this tiny kitchen, relatively, going through, like, the cooking, the prepping, the plating, serving things out. It's like 800 degrees in there, and everyone is, it's like it's so well choreographed, and I love seeing that, and that's the thing that really draws me into it. You know, I mean, you see, like, the concentration that it takes to really, like, put on something like that, and I get to be in there, you know. This was a Japanese knife making demonstration I shot for a client. It was a demo at this outdoor market in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And you know, I mean, I could have been on the other side with these folks with a beer in hand, but I mean, I was able to get closer up, you know, and that's been one of the things that I've really enjoyed about like my sort of type of photography and like what I've been doing. Sometimes you end up in an ostrich farm. Ostriches are totally weird. They're like dinosaurs. They're huge. And I shot this for an assignment last summer for Edible Jersey. And sometimes you get to see a guy with a pig's head on a stick. I actually shot this a couple of years ago, and it's been one of my favorites for a long time just because it's so bizarre. But over the course of my sort of career in all this, I've actually, just this morning as I was putting this together, I realized, oh, hey, I know that guy. Like, I've gone to his restaurant to shoot other things, and, like, you know, I've been wanting to work with him on things, and I realized that, like, we were just a couple feet away, like, 5 years back or whenever this was. And I'm on Instagram. It's Ultra Clay. I don't know if any of that made sense. But that's sort of what I do. That's how I got into it. Yeah, so I guess that's it, right? So I guess questions?
Exposures at night, so there's very, very limited light available, and so it's only the light that comes in through the windows of whatever space it is that I'm making the images of. So it's controlled. There was a lot of massive failures when I was first figuring out how to do it, but I've kind of come up with a little bit of a formula. But I will say one of the things working with expired paper is a lot of them are not as sensitive to light as they used to be, so I can have multiple minute-long exposures now. In some instances, depending on the light.
And then are you also painting with developer?
Not developer. It's a two-part chemical process that I paint with, but it happens in the development of the image.
You guys both, I feel like, have stories around the work that last year with, like, this moment on Earth, meaning the scarcity of the paper.
forced to write about my work on a regular basis, mostly because I'm doing the whole gallery exhibition circuit, so I have artist statements aplenty. It's tough. I do think about that a lot, the kind of immediacy of what I'm doing, but also that there's this weird play with time that happens, in that it takes a really long time, longer than normal to make the exposure, but then sometimes there'll be days before I actually make the image from when it's recorded. I do try and write about it. I'm far more visually literate than I am articulate with words. So I think other people have done a much better job than me about writing about my work. But I do think it's really interesting how that starts to happen. I actually, instead of words, I sometimes will play with sound, and recording the spaces that I'm actually, like, recording both ways. That idea of translating things between mediums is something that I'm really interested in. So that comes visual, then oral, then words for me.
For me, I started out writing more and then shooting to go with the words. I still do write a bit. I have a blog that I swear is going to be updated sometime. I have like 30 different drafts of posts that are at some point all going to go up. I do try to write about what's happening and what, you know, tell a little bit more of the story and give some more of the background. And it's always sort of a back and forth for me because in college and after college, I was very much more focused on words and descriptions of like what's happening. And now as I lean more towards I've gone in the other direction with photography being my sort of main thing, it's harder for me to think about explaining things the same way as I used to. But I still do want to. Brian?
Sort of similar question, but Andy, you talked about the photos and recordings and all that, and you just mentioned sound. And Clay, you talked about sort of documentary and also a lot of work. And I don't have a specific question, but I wondered if you guys could talk a little bit more about the photograph as a recording.
As far on my side, capturing the moment is just it's one of those things where it's more about. I'm shooting a lot of action. I mean, I also shoot a lot of still life with food and all of that stuff. But a lot of the stuff that actually gets me excited is really about the action that's going on and the people and the movement. So, yeah, that's certainly a big part of I think what I do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is action. Your question comment is something that I've kind of, this is what I nerded out on when I was in grad school. I read a lot of photo theory and maybe too much. It's really interesting to me right now. Like there are a lot of people who are very important in the world of photography and who are talking about that, like the whole concept of like the index of the photo where you have a one-to-one relationship between what's in front of the camera and what exists in real life. And that's been a big premise of art photography for a very long time. And there are a lot of people right now who are actually saying that that's worthless. Not worthless. That we shouldn't be focused on that. We should shift our attention because of what's going on with surveillance cameras and with iPhone photography and the prevalence of image making right now. Like the idea that everything is being indexed constantly. So we shouldn't be always referencing the index when we talk about fine art photography. But the idea of recording something that I think that is inherent to what photography is, which is what, like, one of the reasons that I stripped away the camera is that it's that kind of light hits something and reflects off of it and goes into the camera. That's the most fundamental principle of how photography works. But I for me, I actually was like, okay, what happens if it doesn't reflect off of something into a camera? What if you just capture the light right then? So I think that's why I talk about recording light a lot in my work, because it's kind of really something I've thought a lot about.
Have you ever worked
with
raw
images
of images so wide, so
wide? Yeah, I shoot entirely raw files. That's just sort of the standard these days. It's what, I mean, to get into the sort of technical aspect of it, the reason is when you're capturing the image, a raw file is capturing more data. It's actually capturing the larger color range instead of just saying, okay, this is the photo. And it gives you more control over making adjustments afterwards. I don't use Photoshop so much. In fact, I don't know the last time I used it. Most of the things that I'm adjusting are the colors, which again, like the camera captures sort of the entire range or most of the range when you're shooting it. So you're not really making changes as much as you're adjusting what was captured to look more or less in a certain direction. The same with exposure and the brightness and the contrast. And of course, like cropping and any other, you know, image sort of cutting. So I mean, that's mostly what I do. I don't really mess around too much with like the more advanced features. I've not, but I know people who have. And I mean, in the same way that Amy's talking about recording and capturing, you know, capturing images with light one way or the other. I mean, it's a scanner is just basically a different type of camera.
Be interesting if you scanned food. Put the food right on the scanner.
Nice. It would probably be bad. The IT guy in me says,
wouldn't
no,
be
that's
horrified.
Terrible. Yeah, I don't know.
You'd get kicked out of most digital labs.
Probably. Yeah.
I gave a vehement head shake, but that's more a visceral reaction than an intellectual one. it's really interesting. So I teach photography, and there was a period maybe about 7 or 8 years ago where a lot of the top art schools were starting to scale down their darkrooms or even shut them down altogether. One of the most famous incidences was that the School of Visual Arts in New York City does not have a darkroom anymore. Parsons does, and a couple other schools around there still do, but SVA got rid of their darkroom. Their photo program is now all digital. But in the last 5 years, I would say, every place that I'm teaching at, there's more enrollment in chemical photography. It's like, there's been an upswing. I think there are so many young people right now where everything is digital and everything is immediate, that there's something really tactile and very craft-oriented about being in the darkroom that you don't get with digital, that I think it's having a little bit of a resurgence. I want to say desperately that it will never disappear. I know a lot of people who are, like, dyed-in-the-wool. They shoot 8x10 film still, and they're not going to ever give it up. And they're like, if I have to, I will make my own paper. Like, I'm not giving it up. I had a moment on Monday. Like, I was trying to order paper on Monday. And I'm down to 4 options. And I think there used to be like 8 or 10, maybe as recent as 7 or 8 years ago. So there's been a pretty big shift that's happened, but I had the moment where I was like, I'll make my own paper if I have to. And then I was like, wait a minute, you really don't want to do that. But it's interesting if you talk, so I go to all the photo nerd conferences and all this kind of stuff, and the guys who work for Kodak and work for Ilford and work for the big companies, they all still talk about the fact that if you, like, Kodak went bankrupt, which was horrible, and now Calumet's gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
Which is...
They always sucked.
Yeah, they did. B&H is still going strong. But it's really interesting to me that they stand up and they say, like the guy from Kodak said, the film department was never in the red. We always were still turning a profit. It was that Kodak invested their money in digital and that went belly up. Right. So I don't know. It's very strange. I'd be interested to hear your take on what's going on just in terms of the way that commercial photography and more like getting things in print, the way, because that has totally changed.
Right. So I like shooting film, and I do it as a sort of hobby, but in terms of practical, professional work, just in terms of, shooting an event, shooting in a kitchen, shooting, in tight spaces where people are moving around and you have to be able to get something and you want to make sure you get that shot because otherwise you don't get paid. Or you get paid, but then no one will hire you again. It's not, it doesn't really work. But that said, there are a lot of folks I think there has been a resurgence. If you go to the usually overpriced Lomography stores all over the place, they are sort of, they exemplify that there's there really is an interest in Holgas, in Dianas, in the plastic cameras.
The Impossible Project.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So Polaroid stopped making Polaroid. Like you couldn't make they didn't make Polaroid anymore, and you had all of these, and I say this, I'm allowed to say this because I kind of was part of that scene, but like the hipsters were like, wait a minute, where'd the Polaroid go? I need my Polaroid.
Right.
And so they started something called the Impossible Project, and they've recreated the emulsion, and they now have a substitute for Polaroid. You have a question?
This is your full-time job.
For
me?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that was a, that was a process. No, I still have my, my rather large 5D Mark II, Mark III, which is now even bigger than my Mark II because I got the power pack and the whole thing. So yeah, it takes up a fair amount of space. It's just the better gear as far as I'm concerned. I'm not, interestingly, interestingly to me, despite my time here as a geek and my time as an IT guy, I'm totally not a gearhead when it comes to equipment. I know a lot of folks who are like, I'm buying a new lens like every time I get a payday, and in terms of practical use, I have two lenses I need on a regular basis. I have my fixed 50 1.2 and my 24-70, which, if I'm honest, that's going to be the lens I'm using most of the time. I love the 50, but the 24-70 is what gets me paid. Is that an issue in finance?
Not so much in finance. It's really, so I've actually taught at the New England School of Photography, which is a commercial school, so I know more about that from a commercial end, from a teaching end.
Right.
For fine art, the internet has been genius because it's free advertising, and you can put your work in front of people that before there were all these barriers to be able to get access to them. Like, major gallerists are on Facebook. And eventually you know somebody who knows them, and you can put your work in front of them, and it gets you access in a way that you never had before. So most artists are less concerned. I know, I have a whole group of friends in Boston who somehow they all are, tag-teaming, and they're going viral on Facebook. And, they're getting picked up by Petapixel, and then they get picked up by the Huffington Post. And it's, like this crazy kind of cycle. So for fine art, it's been a boon, but I'm sure for you, it's
a little more complicated. I think it depends on how old you are and how long you've been in photography. There are the folks who came up in the age of a staff photographer, of, you know, you've got a regular steady gig, they get really, really pissed off about the way things have become. Between publication, you know, the media industry generally losing a lot of their funding, and everybody sort of posting things for free, it has certainly undercut them. I came up, I started about 10 years ago or so, and it was already, that was already, like, not, you know, that was already not an option, you know. Getting a staff photographer gig is super unusual now, and short-lived. If you have it, it's, you know, you hold on to it as long as you can. Basically, it's all hustle. You're always promoting yourself. You're using the you're using social media as much as possible, and you know, you have to just constantly be promoting yourself and your work. Sometimes that means, and this gets into a much larger conversation about working for free and giving away your work and a lot of things that that are fairly controversial and, like, people will get very up in arms about. I have worked for exposure, but I do it very carefully. Everybody wants you to work to give them your work for free, and they're going to tell you that it's going to be in front of all of these people. But if it's something you've literally never heard of before, you know, like, it'll happen a lot where, you know, someone from some website that I've never ever heard of, and you look and it's like it's this small, and no one, you know, they can't possibly be getting that much traffic. They're going to tell you, oh, we want to get all these images from you because it's, you know, and you're going to get all this exposure. We get this many views and we're really popular. And it's like, after you've been around for a little while, you know that they're you know, kids on the earth, they're full of shit. I mean, it's just not, you know, I mean, you have to be very sort of, you have to educate yourself in what's going on and what other people are doing. And using things like Instagram and stuff like that is really an important way for folks to put their work out there. You know, I follow and am followed by a lot of people who, you know, I hope will hire me for things. And that's sort of what you're doing now. Is like you're putting out work, not necessarily like you're, you know, all of your top work and giving everything away, but you're putting out things so that people will see it and think, like, oh, when I need somebody to shoot that sort of thing, I'm going to hire Clay. Yep.
Let's talk about the start of your research and some interest in paper. Why is that? Is there things you can do with paper you cannot do with
I think, and I'm sure you have an answer for that. As somebody who goes back and forth, I mean, there is a little bit of a novelty to it. There is because everything is so immediate, and because I shoot with a 32 gig card, and I can get something like 1,100 photos without having to download anything. And there's a change in value between that and, you know, a 36 exposure roll. There is, you know, it takes more time to craft something. And honestly, that's exactly why I couldn't do it professionally. I mean, I couldn't shoot film for my professional clients because, you know, they're on a deadline, I'm on a deadline, things have to get done quickly, you know, and if that means that I'm going to throw out like 300 images at the end of the day because they're not even there, you know, they're not what I want, then so be it. If you're doing that with film, you're going to spend a lot of money. The reason that
you... I
like to think of digital and analog or chemical, however you want to phrase it, as being kind of two sides of the same coin. They both are about recording light, recording images, but I think digital has some strengths to it and records certain types of light better than analog. Analog can, you know, I teach photography, so I have a lecture that's stuck in my head right now. The first thing that I teach my students is you don't overexpose digital. It looks like crap, and it's really, like, it's the worst thing you can do technically unless it's done intentionally. Film, you can overexpose, and it looks beautiful, and it can be gorgeous. And so there are different biases to the two mediums. I think the cost benefit of digital is why everything commercial is digital now. It's a novelty, as Clay exactly said, it's a novelty thing. It can sometimes distinguish you in a market if you can do analog. I think academically there's a resurgence to the chemical process because it doesn't, like, teaching college-age kids right now, they're really and truly, everything for them is on the computer. Everything is digitized. Everything is in front of a computer. An opportunity to be in a room, the dark room, where you're not in front of a computer is rare for them. And to, you know, they don't have a single computer-based assignment in my class. Everything is books or, you know, handouts or working physically, tactilely with your hands. And so I think that's something that's very different in a lot of ways for the kind of generations that are coming up. So I think that's part of what the resurgence is coming out as. I know a lot of, there was a huge push and everything went digital in the fine art world for a while. And then everything started looking the same. And there are ways to distinguish yourself doing that. And I know a lot of people that still shoot digitally for fine art, but I think there's also, there are properties of chemical photography that are unique. So it's kind of expands the conversation about the medium.
So can you look at an image and say, hey, that was made digitally, or that was made analog?
If it was made well, no. If it was made poorly, I can tell. The good ones, hopefully with the good ones, you don't even care about how it was made.
As far as as far as travel goes, I mean, whenever I have the opportunity, absolutely. And I've been sort of expanding my range of places that I've been getting clients from, and with the exposure from Edible Jersey, I've been out in New Jersey a lot more. And I'm hoping. And I last year, Tam and I went to Paris, and I got a couple gigs through that. And I'm hoping. I mean, really, what I would love to do is to find my next sort of, I'd like to, you know, New York is a big town with a lot of people doing the same, you know, doing a lot of the same things. And so what I'd like to be able to do is take that sort of thing that I'm doing to other places. Like the projects I've been working on behind the scenes, at butchers, at restaurant, in restaurant kitchens, marketplaces, farms, whatever. I'd like to be able to say, okay, I'm going to do that in another place, and be able to sort of do a larger, take that project larger, so it's not just, this is the stuff in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
That's a good question. I'm attempting very much to kind of show my work more. I'm always looking for opportunities to do site-specific work. That's something that really interests me, and I'm hoping to take the chemical process back up to the mural scale, which I'm hoping happens this summer. But it's one of those things where things come in fits and starts for me. Like, I don't have a gallery, I'm not represented. A lot of that is because of where I am in Boston. Boston is still pretty conservative in some aspects, particularly when it comes to photography. There's not a lot of non-representational photography in Boston. And so a lot of times the gallerists, they look at me and they look at the, you know, like particularly the murals, they're like, that won't fit in my gallery and I don't know anybody that would buy that. And I've made peace with that. I really like working with nonprofits and kind of academic institutions because I teach. I'm really interested in how my process kind of fits into people understanding what photography is. So I would love to see more of that in the future. Girl has dreams. There's the De Cordova Biennial, which is a major art biennial that's up in the New England area, which would be amazing to kind of get my work seen by larger groups of people rather than just in kind of smaller spaces, but we'll see. You know, you keep plugging away. Yesterday, before leaving, I was actually, calls for entry is, if anybody's interested in a career in arts, do calls for entry. it's the teacher side of me. I was doing calls for entry yesterday morning, still trying to get my work in front of people and trying to get it seen by more people, because I think one of the really hard things for me is that everything is digital, the way that you show your work. Like, if you submit your work to have it be juried or seen by a gallerist, unless you can physically get to them in person, they're looking at something on a screen, and my work is not nearly as interesting on a screen as it is in person. I'm always working on that. That's the one moment I wish I was doing digital.